This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the New York City Police Department was forced to lighten up on stop and frisk. So now the cops are staging huge raids on public housing and charging hundreds of young people with criminal conspiracy. And Mumia Abu-Jamal, remembers the people's lawyer, Lynn Stewart.
But first, the National United Anti-War Coalition, UNAC, will hold its yearly conference in Richmond, Virginia on June 16th through the 18th. The theme of the conference is the need for an independent path, meaning a path to peace that is independent of the two corporate parties. UNAC Sarah Flounders explains.
Many, many people can see the need for an independent movement. If you're going to in any way oppose the war policy that's going on right in front of you and the trade agreements that send millions of jobs abroad for corporate profit, it becomes clear to a lot of people the need for an independent movement. The difficulty right now is in the face of the extreme reaction, racism, white supremacist, Trump administration. There was an explosive movement from below, and then you have the Democratic Party running to get in front of it and head it in another direction. And that's what we see now, that the Democratic Party forces want to convince the whole population, first of all, that they lost the election not because of a rejection of their policies and not because they went along with the disenfranchisement of millions of Black voters and not because of everything they did to destroy any effort at even the Bernie Sanders movement, which was a weak movement to begin with, but was the one sign of struggling for an alternative within the Democratic Party. They defeated all that, and now they want to convince us that they lost the election because of Russian hacking, not because of anything they did, but because there was an effort coming from Russia to hack some emails, and that's why people voted against Hillary Clinton, or that's why people voted for Trump. It's so far-fetched when you first think of it that it's impossible it would be believed, even taken seriously. And yet repeated again and again and again, endlessly, huge investigations, daily leaks, all the media attention. You know, you throw enough shit, some of it sticks. That's the reality. And so today, that's become the issue.
And yet, despite the avalanche, the tsunami, one could pick the word, of allegations, there's been no proof even that the Russians had anything to do with the WikiLeaks revelations.
That's absolutely true. Now every country, by the way, is hacking and leaking and doing everything it can. And the U.S., as Snowden's exposés proved, had the megadata for the entire world. All electronic information, every cell phone, every letter, as a matter of fact, dropped in a mailbox, along with everything on a computer, every text, every internet message for everyone in the whole world, not just internationally, right here in the U.S. That's what was being gathered by the National Security Agency. His expose showed that the head of state, whether it's the president of Brazil or the prime minister, Germany, personal cell phones, encrypted phones, the National Security Agency had it for everyone, for every invoice, for every trade deals, everything that was being gathered. So the fact that the U.S. does it isn't news to anyone. But the charge is that Russia used it politically to tip the election toward Trump. And it's so ridiculous that that is what decided people on an election. Where what was Hillary Clinton offering? She was promising, isn't this wonderful? You're going to have more of the same for another 8 years, and adding all kinds of military threats to it. Now, That was rejected. And there were also, as I say, the people who couldn't vote, people who stayed at home rather than vote. Trump won the election, at least by the vote of the Electoral College. And the Clinton forces really are also, there's an effort to even hold on to the Democratic Party. There's sort of an explosion going on within the Democratic Party who want to, those who want to keep things the same, those who want some smudge of a difference. So they're fighting among themselves, but all the time blaming Russian hacking. So this says, let's look at an outside, and it means they also moved far to the right. That's why they're trying to head the movement off, that rather than talk about the racism of Trump, rather than talk about the immigrant ban, we're going to blame Russia for everything and move toward a war mobilization. It's extremely, extremely dangerous because, of course, that's exactly where Trump also wants to go, despite his promises, despite his public face that he wanted a new relationship with Russia. It's really the question of, could he turn and divide Russia and China? Could he focus attention on China, on Iran, on other wars? It's not that he wants a new direction in terms of ending U.S. aggressive military positioning anywhere in the world. So on every level, this is a phony argument and very necessary to completely reject it. Reject it because we don't place a bit of confidence in the Republicans or the Democrats. They're the same, essentially. They both represent Wall Street and corporate power. They have different social base, but they both represent corporate power and war in a very, very real way. And when they fight with each other, what do they say? Believe the CIA. No, believe the FBI. And you have people arguing and using as proof information from the CIA, who is set up in order to lie. Its role in politics is sabotage. Its role in politics is to bring down governments around the world and lie about it. So being quoted again and again as a source is just fantastic, or countering the FBI versus the CIA. FBI has the same role domestically. It's about disenfranchisement, and it is about surveillance, and it's about sabotage of people's movements. That's the purpose for which they were created. So you have a lot of frustrated people who are in motion, who, if this is repeated endlessly, you see they begin to pick it up. You see it in signs and posters, and that's always what also what draws attention in the media. Those are the signs that they pick up on.
Yes, one of the many U.S. covert operatives who cited as an authority on the guilt of the Russians is former National Security Director James Clapper, who back in 2013 committed perjury in full view of the United States public to the Congress, denying that U.S. intelligence agencies were collecting data on all Americans.
Right. Such a good example. And they act with surprise. I mean, their role is to lie. Of course they lie to Congress. Of course. Of course they perjure themselves. That's what the role of a spy is to do. And to do it with a straight face. And then you have these Congress people wringing their hands, supposedly trying to get to the bottom of this. And that's about taking it in a different direction. Nonstop on the news cycle about Russian spying, Russian hacking, on and on, just repeated endlessly. It's like, don't look at what we're doing. Look at what we're, quote, saying, you know. Don't look at where this policy is going, the military budget increasing by 10%. Of course, it increased every single year under the Obama administration, too. Under an earlier Clinton administration, every year. Under Bush, every year, the Pentagon budget goes up, domestic programs get cut. It's the way you balance a budget.
And in terms of the supposed split within the Democratic Party, Keith Ellison, who supposedly represents the progressive wing of that party, and Tom Perez, who supposedly represents the Clinton-Obama wing of the party, are in total agreement about the culpability of the Russians and the necessity for the U.S. to continue its proxy and not-so-proxy war against Syria.
And that's absolutely true. They're both completely online with the program. And even between the intelligence agencies, the CIA makes one revelation, and then the FBI will come around and say, yes, that's true, that what the CIA says is true. I mean, it's stunning. It's impossible to actually wrap our heads around. And at the same time, as you say, the war in Syria not only rolls on, another 1,000 U.S. troops stationed. And also just yesterday, another 1,000 troops to Afghanistan. So the wars continue and are slowly actually ratcheting up in dangerous, dangerous ways. U.S. positioning, missile shield in Korea. You know, even as we speak, very aggressive moves south of China Sea. So the threats are absolutely continuing and very real. Positioning, you wonder what provocation is being prepared in order to stampede the population, now having tried to furiously disorient.
So in terms of political splits, the real split appears to be within what passes for a U.S. left, with much of the folks who call themselves progressives joining with the Democrats and the overwhelming bulk of the Republicans in this anti-Russian hysteria.
Well, there is a part of the, I guess they're left, but they're not really in my book at all, of the social democratic forces who've always been with the Democratic Party and with U.S. wars. And while they can seem more progressive on a social agenda, when it comes down to war, every single war, Libya, Syria, Iraq, we could go all the way back, they end up supporting and saying how urgently necessary it is. Later, they might release a disclaimer when things aren't going so well, but every single war, they absolutely do support and support the basis for the war. That's their role, to misorient and disorient the population. And it's a very important role in class society in the U.S. is to jump to the head of every movement. Now, they're not all powerful. There are things happening within the U.S. today that are really worth taking note, that this movement from below is not always under their thumb and can begin to move in ways completely separate from their role in keeping it corralled, keeping it in tight lines. The sheer number of actions of people in the streets, we always got to like look at that and figure out, do we just let these misleaders take this movement, or do we actually vie with them, try to take it in a different direction every single time, every action, every demonstration, every conference, every meeting? Can we help shape an independent movement? And can we also consciously reject the Russia baiting, hacking stories and say, no, we don't go along with that. We're going to address the wars here at home and abroad. That's the real issue. And we're going to link together the struggles against racism, the immigrant bashing, the attacks on Muslims, and counter those. We're going to stand up to that. Now, sometimes the Democrats will be right in there, too. They're declaring sanctuary cities right and left. At the same time, like we can see here in New York, they go right along with the broken windows policy, with all kinds of arrests that lead to immigrant deportations, with all kinds of policies that continue the attacks on Muslims while pretending to be against it. So it's not ever accepting that they have the people's interests at heart at all, and at the same time pushing a genuine left, meaning a genuine opposition that comes from below, that comes from the grassroots, and that rejects both political parties. That's what's needed, and I think it's more a possibility today than it has been in decades. You have new young activists in the streets that are not looking to Hillary Clinton, and they're not expecting this to just be about voting. Now, can we sharpen that more? I think that's what we have to give a lot of thought to how to do.
UNAC has always tried to gather as many forces as possible into an anti-war movement. But with this hysteria over Russia, I would expect that at the Richmond conference in June, the questions of who's left and how can one unite those folks who are genuinely anti-war will be a top priority.
It's the priority. It's really the kind of movement we have to build. Are we going to look to the Democratic Party and be passive and assume that they have our interests at heart ever? Not for a minute, they don't. So it really has to be how we build independent activity, independent struggles, make our own demands, and not look to a political machine that always is designed, it's designed to sell out the people, to make big promises. And we saw that through this past election, take up all the air, literally sort of take up all the oxygen. That was rejected. And this is really an empire that is decaying. It no longer has the hold internationally or on the population here that it has had for more than 100 years. You see it around the world. What can they offer besides war, military dominance? The economic incentives, capitalism is in such decay, they can no longer offer progress and development and modernization, even as a promise. They can't rebuild what they destroyed. They'd like to. They'd very much like to. But we can look at the wars in Iraq and in Libya, and no, they can't rebuild the countries they destroy. They can leave them in a smoking ruin, and that may be of some short-lived benefit to them. Price of oil, a smidge, taking oil offline and things like that. But they can no longer do what they once had the capacity for. So in that sense, this really is a declining empire, a decaying system. And its political hold is lessening. So you have the intelligence agencies and the political parties at war with each other in a way that's never been before. Trump claim about Obama and criminal charges, and you even have the FBI now. That puts them in a strange position. They can't go along with that. They can't accept that, or they're criminally liable. So you have the very intelligence agencies fighting with each other and running exposés on each other. Now, that is a crazy day in U.S. politics, but it shows that all these powerful institutions are fraying and losing their hold in big ways. And it's also happening in the economy. The only way that it can go forward is with speculative bubbles. So Trump takes off all kinds of regulations. All these capitalists who see only immediate profits are all excited. They're giddy right now. Oh, my goodness, what this means in oil and in fracking. And they're so excited. Pharmaceuticals, they just see dollar signs. It's just being set up for a new, even more dangerous crash. It's like taking away all speed limits and not thinking that there won't be spectacular crashes and accidents.
With these arguments within the ruling class and the public participation of what people call the deep state, it sometimes seems as if the rulers are fouling their own nest, undermining the very institutions that have been very, very good to the rich folks of the United States ever since the republic was founded.
Isn't it almost funny to watch? It's amazing to see them attack each other in ways that they've never done before. And that is attacking the credibility of the very institutions, sacred institutions they've created, whose credibility is supposed to be beyond the pale. Here's a media that we know always lies. Fake news, that's nothing new for any genuine leftist. And yet it's such a common term now. They're busy breaking up any hold that the media has on the population at large. It's laughable. It's so funny to see major corporate media engaging in this level of attacks and of stabbing of each other and of exposés and what's news and what's information. It's all created news meant to keep us enchained to a system that is based on the worst forms of exploitation and keep it hidden. And now all this is sort of coming out into the light in pretty ugly ways. Some of it's funny to watch, but it shows how cutthroat, how really cutthroat and frantic they're becoming.
Isn't it ironic that the corporate media and the folks that the corporate media serves charge that the Russians are undermining U.S. institutions to try to destabilize society? Well, they seem to be doing a pretty good job of it themselves.
They certainly are. It really doesn't need Russia to do it for them. They're busy every day, and it's cutthroat. It's really ugly to watch. It's funny to watch. But in most of this, Russia's completely a bystander. Now, Russia's a capitalist state. They're operating in their own interests. No doubt about that. The old Soviet Union completely overturned, nationalized property for the most part, overturned. But Russia isn't a powerful imperialist country. It's a capitalist state trying to survive complete U.S. domination, complete colonial relationship. So it finds itself in an alliance with other countries also seeking to steer clear of being totally under the U.S. thumb. So any country seeking an independent course today finds ways of finding each other. This is true for Russia and China and trade deals, and for Syria and Iran. It's true for Venezuela. It's true for countries in Africa. They are looking around, trying desperately to find a way to get out from under complete control, have independent policies that are in the interests of their own people, some of them in the interests even of a national capitalist class, but for development. And each time, time and again, they come up against U.S. military domination and threats. And whether it's assassination or sabotage, or their new form is ISIS, certainly armed, orchestrated, trained through Saudi Arabia, but very much operating in U.S. interests throughout the whole Middle East, throughout the Muslim world, how to bring in extreme fanatical forces to undermine the existing societies there. Each of these countries struggling against it are trying to hold together secular multinational states that can cooperate. They don't want to be pulled down by feudal fanaticism.
It seems that the fault line in the world today is between U.S. imperialism and those nation states that are trying to preserve at least their sovereignty.
That's exactly. Those are the dividing lines. Any form of sovereignty, of independence on a local level, any level of trying to be independent of these deadly trade deals is seen as an affront to the U.S. empire and therefore targeted. Some of it, though, you see what's happening with Trump. Now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership went down in defeat because of opposition internally, opposition from some of the countries themselves. But its original purpose was to be an alliance against China. Every country of the Pacific Rim in it, except China. But they couldn't pull it off. They couldn't pull it off because U.S. imperialism is not the powerhouse it once was. And that's an interesting example of the new day that we're in.
That was Sarah Flounders of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition.
Under the supposedly liberal mayor, Bill de Blasio, New York City cops have scaled back their stop-and-frisk practices, but have dramatically increased their sweeps of public housing projects, resulting in the arrest of hundreds of people on RICO conspiracy charges. The cops call the policy precision policing. Josmar Trujillo of the Coalition to End Broken Windows says the sweeps have had a devastating effect on poor communities in Harlem and the Bronx.
We've taken aim at this precision policing model, which is one where they focus on predominantly public housing residents, young men, usually black and Latino, say that they're in gangs and raid and militarize pre-dawn operation of an entire housing development, sweep up dozens of young men, and using association and conspiracy, charge them, you know, with laws that were designed to take on the mafia in the 70s, RICO, and at the state level, conspiracy, and really kind of bury them under these prosecutions. So that's where the department has started to focus more now in the quote-unquote post-stop-and-frisk era. And that's an area where we're prepared to meet them head-on, because this is kind of a continuation of stuff that was going on in the 90s, but it's also part of the legacy of mass incarceration and the drug war and all of the attacks that are well-documented on Black and Latino communities.
Yes, precision policing sounds like precision bombing, as in World War II attacks against cities. And broken windows philosophy of policing harkens back to a past in New York City.
Yeah, NYPD, you got to give them credit for their public relations department. They're always slapping on a new word to policing, whether it's community policing or precision policing or neighborhood policing. They always feel the need to add something to policing to make it sound not as bad as what it really is, which is policing. So precision policing, yeah, it's very much an echo of kind of like the counterinsurgency or overseas efforts that the military takes, where they say we're doing precision bombing or precision operations, or, you know, like the Israeli Defense Forces, they say they're very precise. You know, they're only going after the bad guys, the ones who deserve it, you know. So the NYPD takes the same kind of position, because obviously after the whole stop and frisk debate and fight, it was clear that they were just so overtly kind of doing just dragnet style policing and profiling that they wanted to focus in on a group of people that they believe that no one will advocate for. And if you put a gang label on someone and you take away that person's humanity, it's much easier to bury them with policing and prosecutions, but also it's much harder to get people to defend them or advocate on their behalf. So they've kind of found a new niche for themselves.
Yes, this precision policing is anything but precise, and it's had devastating effects on the mainly public housing projects that it's been directed at.
Well, precision policing and the NYPD has been a little sensitive about the even just the word sweeps. When people talk about you taking, for example, last April in East Chester Gardens, you taking 120 people and you putting them down as gangbangers, and you put their face in the newspapers and through in the 10 o'clock news, and, you know, you take them out of the community and off the street, many of them raising kids, some of them working two jobs. Many of them were even just at home living with their moms. These were not like the drug kingpins that they were meant to be. The NYPD doesn't like us to, or even journalists, to use the word sweeps, because even that sounds not precise enough for them. And that's exactly what it is. It's a sweep. It's a militarized operation. In the Bronx raid, they had five or six federal agencies with helicopters overhead. You had an armored car from the Department of Homeland Security sitting in the middle of a housing development in the Bronx. You had a militarized operation, and not only psychologically, what does that do to that community, but after the fact, what happens to people's housing status? Are they going to be evicted? There's pretty notorious housing and eviction history of trying to get people out once you've criminalized them. Not even necessarily convicted them, but if you've been arrested of certain crimes, New York City Housing Authority can start to move towards evicting you, or at the very least putting you on a permanent exclusion list, which can affect not only yourself, but other people in your family who live there. So it presents a lot of problems, and a lot of people and parents and advocates have said that, you know, this is part of efforts in the city and in other urban cities to gentrify the last bastion of housing that poor people can afford, which is public housing. So there are connections to gentrification, and there's connections to kind of displacement that have to be talked about and have to be explored.
And the city and the police are very thorough in getting the collaboration of the news media. It seems like an incarceration and arrest extravaganza being staged.
Oh, absolutely. They're partners in crime on this one, because what better way than through newspapers and mainstream news programs to convict someone, not just in the courtroom, but in the court of public opinion, than by putting them on a newspaper cover or showing their image for 5 seconds on the 10 o'clock news, and it just says gangs or terrorizing, or they're, you know, they talk about the shootings. You know, in the case of Eastchester Gardens, you had 120 people indicted, and you had, I think, one or two actual murders. So, you know, they try to squeeze out as much criminalization as they can, and the media is more than willing to go along with it because, for them, it's also a great story. You create this enemy of gang members, even though we have, like, record low crime levels in the city, you create this imagery and or this myth of there being this huge gang problem in New York, which there isn't. In this city, we don't have a gang presence like in other cities. But you create that image, and you have the NYPD, the world's, I think, seventh largest standing army. You need an enemy. And what better enemy than to create one and just say, you know, a couple of young men from public housing developments are, you know, the second coming of John Gotti. And now you have the perfect enemy, and the newspapers love it, and they run with it because there is no John Gotti anymore in New York. But you can definitely take, you know, a young man from Eastchester Gardens or a young person from West Harlem and play them up in the media like they Lucky Luciano, and there's a new story.
Now, all of these folks in these housing projects have elected officials who are supposed to represent them. How have they behaved in the face of these depredations?
The political class in New York City is, say what you will, they're at least consistent in how much they bend over backwards to accommodate the police department. In the Bronx, I can definitely say council member Andy King has been supportive, if not just ignorant of what's going on. He was at a community meeting that happened after the raids, which are like these meetings that the NYPD feels compelled to hold because people are so outraged. They have this meeting to kind of try to quell or calm down, you know, things from getting out of hand from there, for being like protests and stuff. So they had this community meeting, and Andy King was there, like standing alongside the prosecutors and the NYPD and saying, yeah, I agree with this. Yeah, I do think that if a few young men are all wearing the same hats, or if they're all wearing the same colors, then that means they're in a gang. So someone like Andy King is obviously either ignorant to what's actually happening in the black community, or he's just complicit in what's going on, and he's just part, like, with the media and the NYPD and federal law enforcement agencies, he's just part of the problem.
So how are you working to combat not just the police department, but this whole city political structure that backs them up?
Yeah, there's been a lot of groups that have been working on this and responding to things at certain levels. Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee has been working with some family members. Take Back the Bronx, Why Accountability, and a bunch of other groups have been taking the lead and at least showing up and rallying it after Eastchester Gardens. After the raid in Eastchester Gardens, a lot of them held a rally there, and they connected with residents. So there's just kind of the first stage of getting to meet and talking with residents and figuring out what's going on. You know, in one raid, you can have dozens and dozens of families all with their own issues. So meeting and talking with them and connecting them has been something that we've been working towards. And that requires, like, going with them. And iWalk has been great that they go and support them with letter writing campaigns, or they support them by showing up at their court dates. So that's the first step. And the next step is to really launch a campaign and figure out what are some of the resources we can give not only family members practically. You know, they're facing some of the worst types of charges that you can throw at somebody. So obviously they need legal help. They need resources. The young men who are caught up behind bars, who are being essentially tortured, how can we help them from the outside? That work is happening. But then also long-term, how do we start up a campaign, a very public campaign, to not only say, you know, what the NYPD is doing and has been doing for a long time is outrageous and it's something that's abusive, but also how can we humanize these people to remind the public at large that these are people, that these are young men, and that these are, for the most part, in my opinion, people who are not involved in the violence that they're being alleged to be involved in, but also to tell their stories and explain to people how stacked this game is against them, because they're being paraded through the newspapers. They're being hit with these very, very easy to kind of prosecute or easy to convict conspiracy charges. And they're also being given the worst kind of legal position that one can have, which is one where you have a public defender whose most practical or most rational advice you might be to take a plea deal, because it's so stacked against you, because RICO is so powerful and it's such a hard thing to get over that most of these young men practically have felt the need. And it's just like 90% of the time they're taking plea deals. And so they're getting convicted because to face 50 years, which is where some of the charges that are being thrown at some of these people, is basically throwing your life away. So you would rather take 7 to 10 years. And this isn't even touching on how complex this issue is, but this is the type of things that these young men are facing.
And what are your most urgent demands?
Stop the raids is one thing. I mean, in the Bronx case, again, it was the biggest in the city's history. There was a young man, people don't even know him, that he, in the middle of this thing, he was running to get away because, you know, you had an all-out assault, something like out of a video game with people in infrared goggles, like, coming through and kicking down doors. This guy ran away, was trying to get away over some rooftops and, like, fell to his death. So stopping the raids, because even the raids are just, they terrorize people, but also to start to push back legally to get some kind of public campaign to get these prosecutions thrown out, to get people free. Like, we have to free these young men however way we can. We have to make sure no one is caught in the net anymore. But those are the things. Stop the raids and stop RICO.
Josmar Trujillo of the Coalition to End Broken Windows.
Funeral services were held in New York City this Saturday for People's Lawyer Lynn Stewart, who succumbed to cancer at the age of 77. Stewart represented many political prisoners in her long career, but she herself spent 4 years in federal prison for vigorously representing her clients. The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, pays his respect to Lynn Stewart. That was Mumia Abu-Jamal for Prison Radio.
Mumia and other inmates at prisons across the state of Pennsylvania say they are forced to drink and bathe in brown, smelly, tainted water. The foul water also exacerbates the effects of Abu-Jamal's hepatitis C, an infection that afflicts 5,000 other inmates, but which the state of Pennsylvania refuses to treat. The campaign to bring Mumia home has been organizing national days of action to highlight the water crisis. Black Agenda Report producer Kyle Frazier spoke with organizer Sophia Williams.
It was actually the larger Mumia Abu-Jamal movement that called for these national days of actions. This movement is wide-ranging, and a huge sector of it is located in Philadelphia, as many people may guess. And so we first had a meeting sometime mid to late February, I think that was February 18th, we had an in-person meeting in Philadelphia to speak more on this water crisis within the Pennsylvania prisons and to tie that into a local school in Philadelphia that was also experiencing severe water conditions that were just becoming apparent during that week. So it happened around that time we called for an in-person meeting and we had a pretty good turnout and even had students from the University of Pennsylvania come out. They're doing a project around similar issues as this. And essentially the reason that we called for these National Days of Actions, specifically the first one, which was on March 1st, was to bring serious awareness on this water crisis in the Pennsylvania prisons and connect that to the communities within the state of Pennsylvania, but to connect that to the communities that are being affected by the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, and connect those two issues to the Standing Rock crises, and really to just bring for people's awareness of what's happening with something as important as water. I know that there are many communities that are probably having their own issues and it's not being televised in any kind of way and probably is not getting any public attention of any kind. So we're not just doing this for the prisoners who are clearly seen as others and not even seen as humans many times by our mainstream media and by the system in which we live under. But we're also doing this to connect to other water issues, human life, human crisis issues that can be related and people would want to join in and make these calls and essentially bring attention to an issue that can have detrimental consequences if nothing is done about it.
Could you speak a little bit about the issues around water in Pennsylvania more generally?
I actually have something here that I wanted to quickly mention that goes into this issue. From the Philadelphia Inquirer newspaper, a letter was actually written to the Philadelphia Inquirer. And what it says is that recently President Trump has issued an executive order rolling back the Clean Water Rule section within the Clean Water Act. And it's just incredibly ridiculous that this took place, because the water quality within Pennsylvania has been very low, and it has shown serious unsafe signs for the residents. And within this letter, it was noted that the Penn Environment gave Pennsylvania schools an F for the lead in their water. And also to note, of 40 Philadelphia schools tested, 14% had high levels of lead in their water. So, you know, this clean water section within, again, the Clean Water Act, it allows for local government the means in which to deal with such problems. And with President Trump taking this out, the residents will have a harder time getting access to clean water within the schools. It's being urged for Senators Toomey and Casey to immediately propose legislation to protect Pennsylvanians, particularly the children, in light of Trump's ridiculous executive order. So again, that was from a letter sent to the Philadelphia Inquirer.
It also speaks to the differing impacts that toxic water can have on different communities. Of course, it's heinous that the schools in Philadelphia would have this corrupted water supply. But when you're talking about a completely captive population, the difficulties are then compounded. Could you speak a little bit about the experience of those on the inside due to the toxicity of the water inside the prisons?
A prisoner from SCI Mahanoy, which is where Mumia Abu Jamal is located, and also Eddie Africa of the Move organization, a prisoner from that specific prison noted that he and a number of other prisoners are now seeing fungus-like or fungus-looking conditions that's appearing on their skins. And of course, that's a result of the toxic water. And it's also known that Mumia is still suffering with related issues to his Hep C crisis. And one of those related issues is the skin condition that he has had since, you know, he's had Hep C, and the excessive itching and what it does to his skin. So to have them bathing, showering, and ingesting toxic water into their systems and on their skin is extremely detrimental and extremely dehumanizing. It's also known that Mumia, he does have to take specific required baths within the prison infirmary. And since this crisis for a few months now, since around August, he's unable to do that. And he needs that for his condition. So we see how much this crisis is detrimental to their health. But then we see how unimportant it is to the officials and within the prisons, and to the officials outside of the prisons that can really do something about this. Because again, these people, as you mentioned, are captured, and it's not a important priority for the powers that be to make something happen and for this issue to be cleared up. Another thing I wanted to note was that in Frackville, SCI Frackville, there was an announcement made on the first day that we had the National Day of Action, March 1st. There was an announcement made that the water was safe. So I think that specifically points to the pressure that these calls, these emails, these facts, what have you, that's being made to the prison officials and to the governor of Pennsylvania, how much impact that they're having, that it's not forcing the hands of officials within the prison to make some kind of statement, essentially to make it seem like, okay, well, we're working on this, or this is happening, or this is not happening.
What options do those imprisoned in these facilities have with regard to water? How are they coping with this toxic water supply in the prisons, the only water supply that they have access to?
I'm not sure which prison it is, but I know there is a prison that has, within the visiting room, does have bottled waters, and that's one option. But then in SCI Mahanoy, where Mumi is located, that specific prison, within their visiting room, they don't have that feature. And Eddie Africa, again, of the MOVE organization, the MOVE family, noted that within his cell block, he does have a hot water filter on his cell block. But it doesn't seem like there's that same kind of option located on other cell blocks for the prisoners, for all the other prisoners. So there's this thing where some has this, some doesn't have that, and it definitely seems that most don't have any options, really. They get, I believe it was like 3 cups a day of like filtered water to drink, and that's basically it. They're forced to endure being in this condition and figuring it out on their own or with each other as a collective. How can they avoid this in some essence? But they don't have really much options, and they're, again, forced to handle this matter on their own. And this is why it's important that we are making these demands to the officials to get something done right now.
And expecting individuals who are being paid at best slave wages for their labor to purchase their own bottled water only during visits, which are not always frequent for the imprisoned population, is of course absurd. We know that in Pennsylvania, there have been many environmental issues, particularly that would affect the water supplies. There have been, of course, the reports around lead that we've discussed. There have been reports about coal ash, not to mention chromium 6. And of course, you know, the potential health impacts that are caused by fracking, the extent of which are still not completely known. Is there any sense of what the cause is of this oily, brown, and foul-smelling water in SCI Frackville and SCI Mahanoy?
No, there isn't an exact sense of where the source of this is coming from specifically. But yes, as you mentioned, those various pollutants, I'm sure, have combined to affect the water conditions.
And as we know, prisons are inhabited not only by imprisoned people. Are those working at these facilities drinking the water supplied by SCI Mahanoy or SCI Frackville?
Well, actually, the opposite of that is that those that work within the prisons are allowed to bring in their own water, and they also have access to filtered water there as well. So it's clear that the officials working there are given the green light to drink healthy water and to feel healthy within their own bodies. But when it comes on to the prisoners, which are not even seen as human beings and are living in torturous conditions, they don't deserve to have the same options of having clean water.
And have you heard of any change in that policy of bringing bottled water and avoiding the water supplied by the facilities since this announcement following the day of action that allegedly the water at SEI Frackville is safe to drink?
Unfortunately, I have not.
So to go back to Mumia's health condition, we know that there was a ruling in his favor for him to immediately receive life-saving treatment for that hepatitis C, and there was a 3-week deadline given for the Department of Corrections to provide that medication. Do you have any updates on that? Is Mumia being provided the medication that was demanded by that order?
Well, thank you for touching upon that issue. So no, he has not been treated for his hep C. The DOC has essentially filed a challenge in January. I believe it was 10 days after the judge's ruling. They filed a challenge to the judge's ruling. And of course, the judge's ruling was that for Mumia to be treated with the hep C medications. And essentially, that challenge or stay asked the judge to halt all kind of legal actions and proceedings. In response, our side has filed papers opposing the DOC's request for a stay, and it's just a huge back and forth issue, as the Department of Corrections attorneys also filed a separate notice of appeal in which they intend to appeal the judge's decision in Third Circuit Court of Appeals. So essentially, they are buying time and pushing so hard on not having Mumia receive any treatment as required by the judge, and to continue their project of essentially slowly killing him.
Further proof of the oft-invoked term that justice delayed is justice denied. Do you have any further updates that you would like to provide on the work that the campaign to bring Mumia home is doing, or any announcements that you would like to make for upcoming actions?
Yes, I do have an important announcement that is taking place at this moment, and that is a campaign by the Committee to Save Mumia Abu-Jamal. That campaign is in need of emergency funding for Mumia's attorneys, Bob Boyle and Brett Groat, who were both instrumental in his recent medical court case. The committee has been raising funds quietly since Mumia was facing execution in the 1990s. And since Mumia became gravely ill in 2015, they have been behind on payments to his attorneys, and they need to raise more funds very quickly. So they're asking people to consider making donation and identifying one or two others who may can do the same. There is a PayPal link that can be found at bringmumiahome.com. Also, tax-deductible checks can be made out to the National Lawyers Guild Foundation. And in that memo box, be sure to write for Mumia Abu-Jamal's defense. And again, these important funding details can be found in its entirety at bringmumiahome.com.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.